Hey there, sports history fan. Arnie Chapman here from the Sports History Network. Now, before you jump into this episode, I wanted to share with you an exciting giveaway we have going on with Home Field Apparel. We have a digital $50 gift card to homefieldapparel.com for one lucky fan of the Sports History Network. All you got to do is head over to sportshistorynetwork.com/giveaways to sign up. Again, that's sportshistorynetwork.com/giveaways. This podcast is part of the Sports History Network, your headquarters for the yesteryear of your favorite sport. You can learn more at sportshistorynetwork.com.
Over the years, there are times that a team or player could captivate a city or region or maybe even the entire sport itself. For example, take a look at the Detroit Lions and what they did this year in the NFL playoffs. We've seen this in many different iterations. In the 1970s, there was Bronco mania in the NFL and Blazer mania in the NBA. In the 1980s, it was the phenomenon of William the Refrigerator Perry, a defensive lineman from the Chicago Bears, and also there was the flamboyant running back of the Cincinnati Bengals, Icky Woods, just to name a few. Yet during the 1990s, there was one sports phenomenon on a much smaller scale that caused ripple effects in an area of the United States that the average sports fan would never in a million years, even armed with a couple of cases of brown liquor, would never have been able to put together. Yet in the mid-1990s, South Louisiana had a sports sensation that defied all logical thinking in the world of sports and sports marketing. The Louisiana Ice Gators, a hockey team that was part of the East Coast Hockey League, arrived in the South Louisiana city of Lafayette. And almost overnight, hockey in Louisiana not only worked, but became the hottest ticket in town. Hello, I'm Dana Augusta, your host of the Historically Speaking Sports Podcast, the sports history podcast you didn't know you needed. In this all-new episode, we will talk with former Ice Gators season ticket holder and hockey enthusiast Shane Derouin about the Ice Gators, his great memories of the team, and also what the team meant for the city of Lafayette and hockey in general in the state of Louisiana. Later in the podcast, in the wake of the huge announcement of former Michigan coach Jim Harbaugh agreeing to become the new head coach of the Los Angeles Chargers, we're going to send a shout out to another Chargers coaching great who had success in college and pro football, and also had a knack for developing quarterbacks, and almost single-handedly turned the Chargers around and changed the way the game of football is played, even to this very day. The circumstances of him getting hired by the Chargers is remarkable. And on the day of the announcement, the city of San Diego suffered through the darkest and most tragic day in the history of that Southern California city. The story of Don Coryell and the 1978 North Park plane crash in the shout-out segment. Plus, Super Bowl 58 is set between the Kansas City Chiefs and the San Francisco 49ers, taking place on February 11th in Sin City. This, of course, is a rematch of Super Bowl 54, which took place in Miami in February of 2020. We will talk about that game and the upcoming Super Bowl matchup. That and so much more on this all-new edition of the Historically Speaking Sports Podcast, a member of the Sports History Network.
At the Sports History Network, we're all about the sports yesteryear, and so we're pleased to introduce you to Row One, an online memorabilia gallery and shop that brings sports history to life. The Row One Gallery features over 5,200 gorgeously reproduced prints of team posters, game program covers, game tickets, and advertisements in baseball, pro and college football, pro and college basketball, and more. Any gallery item may be printed in a variety of sizes on wood, metal, canvas, acrylic, or poster paper. It's your choice. In the Row 1 shop, you can pick from thousands of unique items that feature retro and historical backgrounds dating back to 1876. We have everything from clothing to phone cases to mugs, even shower curtains. Go to sportshistorynetwork.com/row1 for access to the full Row 1 catalog. When you buy from the gallery today, you can instantly save 15% on your purchase. All you have to do is enter the code SHN15 and your discount will be applied. That's SHN15. That's it. Simple. Save 15% off all your prints in the Row 1 gallery. Just go to sportshistorynetwork.com/row1. And don't forget to check out all the podcasts on the Sports History Network. Soundtrack provided by Kevin MacLeod of filmmusic.io.
Welcome back to the Historically Speaking Sports Podcast, which is the sports history podcast you didn't know you needed. I'm your host, Dana Augusta, and joining me for this episode is a longtime friend of mine. And what I mean longtime, I'm talking about close to 40 years long. He and I have been knowing each other since junior high, I believe. And he's a very, very good friend of mine, but he's also a hockey enthusiast, and he's also what it was a 6-year season ticket holder of the Louisiana Ice Gators. And if you don't know it, if you live outside of Louisiana, this was one of the biggest sports phenomenons no one's really heard of. But I'm shedding some light on it tonight, talking to this man. So, Shane, welcome to the program. Thank you for joining me.
Thank you. I appreciate you having me.
Now, let's go back to the beginning, okay? Let's go back to the early 90s when it was announced that Louisiana, South Louisiana, more specifically Lafayette, Louisiana, was going to be getting a hockey team. What was your initial reaction when you first heard this?
So, you know, I'm sitting down watching the evening news, and they were talking about a professional sports team coming to Lafayette. So, you know, hockey was the last thing on my mind. I was sitting there thinking, oh, maybe we're getting a semi-pro basketball team, you know, because they said, oh, something's coming to the Cajun Dome. When they announced it was hockey, I had a stunned look on my face. I could not stand hockey on TV. I would always flip the channel. It was so boring to me.
Right.
So I was kind of disappointed at that time.
Now, I mean, with me, I had heard about it, and I was in college at the time. I had heard about it, and it was because I was at Southern, which is in Baton Rouge, and they were talking about also putting a team in Baton Rouge, but they were going to test Lafayette first to see what the market was like, and which made sense, I guess. But because Lafayette at the time, I guess, was a growing city. And a hockey team in South Louisiana, to me, really didn't make a lot of sense. But they needed something in the Cajun Dome. And at the time, it would have made probably more sense of having a semi-pro basketball team. But in this case, hockey. And it was the Ice Gators. And when the wheels got rolling and stuff like that, and you had your first game there, what was your first game like there? I know that eventually it kind of caught on, and it caught on in a big way, to be honest. What was that like, your first experience? You said that you watched it on television and you went to see it in person. Obviously, if you being a season ticket holder, what was the major difference that you saw compared to what it was on TV compared to what it was in real time?
Well, on TV, you know, there was no identity to me. You know, it was something that was foreign. And I again, watching the news one night, and actually the Gators played there, I want to say first two or three games in the, I think it was the Centroplex in Baton Rouge, because the ice was not ready in the Cajun Dome. So I saw the highlights and I was like, okay, they got a decent crowd. Did not go for the first couple of months. And then, just kind of started talking about it with my wife, and we decided to go. Our tickets were at the top because there was quite a few people. It wasn't sold out when I first got there. And I knew nothing about the sport, like none of the rules. So for me to fall in love with the sport right away and not know the rules, I would probably say at that particular time, it would have been the aggressive nature of the sport, the fighting. Because I didn't, you know, why they're blowing the whistle when the guy was way over here with the puck. Did not understand any of that. But that first game, it was more of, hey, man, this is pretty cool. The crowd gets into it. The Cajun Dome has never been more full because obviously with what little bit of events that they had there, aside from college basketball, it, you know, it wasn't full all the time. So it was just exciting. So that's what kind of drew me in initially.
Now, I could speak from my own personal experience. I fell in love with hockey watching NHL. The 94 finals between the Rangers and the Canucks, I watched that series pretty much from beginning to end. And especially overtime hockey was one of the greatest things I had ever witnessed. And I said this one time on an earlier episode that overtime hockey may be the best thing you could actually see in sports. And I can't imagine what it would be like to watch an overtime hockey game in the postseason in person. But I'm more than sure you have watching the Ice Gators and their success. I mean, they played in two Kelly Cup finals in 1997 and in 2001. And for what I could remember of that early, that time, really throughout the entire time the Gators were in Lafayette, it was the hottest ticket in town. You agree with that?
I do agree. I attended every playoff game that was there. Every year was special when it became playoff time. I think back, you can imagine the Cajun Dome filled to the brim. People standing outside at the end of the tunnel that you had to walk under Cajun Dome Boulevard with their fingers in the air to buy tickets because it was the hardest ticket to get. And it was very, very affordable at that time. But I recall a couple of different times with the finals or playoffs in general. I think in the two finals we played Peoria and we lost, and also South Carolina.
That was the one in 2001 when y'all played Peoria.
Yes. Matter of fact, I have a T-shirt from it that says Kelly Cup Champions on it. Okay. We were up 2-0. They came to Lafayette, and we're just smoking them at this point. So we're about to go up 3-0, I believe, 3-0. And so somehow the shirt started being sold that said Kelly Cup Champions.
No.
Well, Peoria came back and won, and we lost the series. So there are some shirts out there that are in circulation that necessarily didn't happen.
That's got to be a collector's item. 2000, it was the 2000. I stand corrected. It was the 2000 final, Kelly Cup Finals, where y'all lost to Peoria. Y'all lost four straight. Y'all won the first two, and then y'all lost the next four. And you think that might have been maybe something worthy of a jinx, maybe? Because that's something that you would hear when somebody, a team would do that, like start selling championship merch before it even ended yet, you know?
It's kind of. Yeah, it felt that way. It definitely felt that way.
Then they had the other one in 97. The other one, y'all lost to South Carolina 4-1, the South Carolina Stingrays. I kind of remember that because I went to a couple of playoff games there. I was fortunate enough to go a couple of the playoff games when they played. I forgot who they played, but it wasn't the finals. But I went to a couple of earlier playoff in an earlier playoff run. I don't exactly remember who they played. I was in college at the time. I don't really remember much of anything from college. But anyway, that's another story for another day. What was your I mean, that had to be up there as far as like one of the great memories. But what is another great memory? Now, remember, I know you're from, I know we're from Louisiana, and I know there's some things in Lafayette that might have happened that's not family friendly, especially at a hockey game. But what are some of your favorite memories from that, from that era and being a fan of the Ice Gators?
So one of the memories I have that has stood with me was, I think we were playing, it may have been Greenville, the Greenville Growl, or it was definitely one of the East Coast teams near Carolinas, where our entire sound system went out.
Mm.
And the crowd took over. So if anyone's ever been to a hockey game, you know, there's music in between face-offs or the puck goes out or just any downtime, it's always busy. But in this particular time, the announcer couldn't get on. They couldn't play music. And the Gators were struggling. And when I say the crowd took over, it was – I still have goosebumps on my arm from that night.
Mm-hmm.
It was just like nothing you've ever heard. And I've been to plenty of other events, other type games. But you felt the energy pushing through you, and the team fed off of that and ended up winning the game. And I want to say that particular game went into overtime. So it was really an edge of your seat type game.
Oh, wow.
But that was probably my top in memory. My second one was we were playing South Carolina, and I don't think this was the playoffs. I think this was like a rematch the following year after they beat us. And there was a bent clearing brawl between the two teams. And I actually have a photo somewhere of me in the crowd standing up with my buddy Doug, went to school with, and we're just like mesmerized. I mean, you've got the goalies from both teams. Everyone's off the bench. There was so much equipment all over the ice. It looked like you were walking to an academy and there were sporting goods everywhere.
I think actually, as doing research for this episode, I think I might have seen a picture. Somebody took a picture from way up top from in the Cajun Dome, and almost the whole ice was completely covered with like different type, all kinds of hockey equipment. Might have been skates, right. Might have been pads, might have been helmets. You know, and just looking at it, at first I thought, well, somebody, it must have been a picture of somebody scoring a hat trick or something, because that was the thing, you throw your hat on the rink whenever somebody scores three goals in the game. But no, this wasn't hats. These were like equipment. And this was like the aftermath of it. And it was like the ice was clear. There was no players on the bench. It didn't look like and everything, but it was taken from way high above. And it was surreal. I'm like, okay, what went on here? You know, and then you said the story, like, that must be it. That must be the picture of the whole of the bench clearing brawl that you talked about. Now, as a resident, longtime resident, native of South Louisiana, as I am, why was it? What was it about that team or about that sport that you think made it so popular in South Louisiana?
Well, I think the newness of it. It was something different. Going to the ice skater game was more than just a game. It was also a chance to gather with your friends. It was a social event.
Right.
Again, I said earlier, the hot ticket in town. And the rivalries that were being created. You know, when the ice skaters first started, they were the only team. Mm-hmm. And then at one point, it was you had Baton Rouge came in the same league. You had New Orleans. Then you had a team in Alexandria, Lake Charles. There still is a team in Shreveport.
Mm-hmm.
And you had three rinks alone in the city of Lafayette or, you know, within that parish. But just the kids gravitated to it. The parents could bring their kids. I, at the time, I think it was like $5 a ticket in the upper level. And if you know the Cajun Dome, they had a lot of seats in the upper level.
Yes.
So you take a family of four for $20. And, you know, it was a good night out that people enjoyed. I remember introducing it to my extended family. I mean, at any time, I had aunts and uncles and cousins. We might have not sat by each other at the game, but prior to the game, we were tailgating like these major professional franchises do. 11,000 plus people doing the chump, which we borrowed from the Florida Gators, all in unison, playing to, you know, the music every after every goal. So the crowd participation was there the entire game. And the fact that the Ice Gators put a winner on the ice. You know, the Saints struggled for so many years, right? And they had mild success. Raging Cajuns football up and down, right? So you really, what you had in the state at that time was LSU.
Yeah.
All right. And LSU was up and coming, right? Yeah. They weren't what they are now or what we know them to be.
Right.
So when the Ice Gators put that, man, people just wanted to be around something that's winning. And the players were part of the community. You know, I belonged to the Ice Gator Booster Club for several years. We hosted a couple of players, you know, because they're away from their family. They're coming from other countries, other states. You get to be friends with them, still friends with a couple. I actually started playing hockey myself. I played for 16 years as a goalie because I couldn't skate at first. Okay. And got to play in leagues, the summer leagues with some of these professional players. And, you know, some of them you learn from and some would try to, you know, take advantage of you on the ice or on the rollerblades, depending, you know, because of their ability.
Right.
But it was fun. It was fun. And so not only the avenue of going to the game, but the kids were playing. There was high school teams. There was, I played for UL for one season on the roller hockey team. You know, there's LSU teams. There are still teams that exist for these colleges. But I just think because of it being a winner and new
right.
is what was the attraction. People wanted to be part of that.
That is very interesting. That I did not know about that you actually played. I knew that you were a big fan of it. I knew that you followed it from seeing you on Facebook and whatnot, but I never knew that you played. What was that like? What was that like, Shane Darrowan, as a goalie for a rollerblade team, rollerblade hockey? What was that like? What was your experience?
So I'm going to take you back. Take you back where it started. So a bunch of us would go on Friday nights on Bank Street, the covered pavilion.
Okay, yeah. Right?
And I had some outdoor, it was like sponge equipment. I mean, it was really, we'd play with a little puck because it would slide on that surface. Mm-hmm. And so it really wasn't nothing serious for me at the time. And then a couple of the guys that I played with, they're like, hey, we're going to play with this team. They were called the Villains. Okay. And we're going to play at the Meltdown, which is over there off by Don's on Johnston.
Okay, I know what you're talking about, yeah.
And so now it's called Planet Ice. It's an ice rink. But back then it was Meltdown. It was roller hockey. And so I get over there, and I had a couple practices with them. The team, a bunch of older guys, right? And I'm like, okay, I know nothing. I don't even have full goalie equipment at this time. I bought some leg pads that were used. I was working at the time, but I didn't make much money back then. So I had to get bits and pieces of the goalie equipment. So I bought a helmet, the leg pads, and I used a karate chest protector. I didn't even have the padded shorts.
Okay.
And we go out there, and I'm the backup, right? They already had their goalie. Well, our goalie gets hurt after the first game. Blew out his knee or something. I don't recall. Mm-hmm. So now I'm the goalie. Well, I go out there and I face a lot of shots, and we had a rough season. I get home, my legs are black and blue because, again, I'm not wearing padded shorts.
Right.
But, you know, hey, it's fun. I'm young. I can take the pain.
Yeah.
Funny, I never wanted to be a catcher in baseball, but I could take the pain playing goalie. Mm-hmm. Remember, I started this because I couldn't skate. Little did I know, playing goalie taught me how to skate from the going back and forth. Well, yeah. Then another roller hockey rink opens called Top Shelf. So now we have two of these, and we still have LA Ice and Karen Crow. Well, at this time I have more money. I fill out my equipment. I've got a nice chest protector. I've got padded shorts. I feel invincible because now I don't feel the puck.
Right.
Well, we actually get better. And then he comes back and I'm like, okay, it was his team. I'm gonna go find another little team to play with. I'll play with the other team. We start a team. Our jerseys were the Nashville Predators.
Okay.
We had another rival team from our hometown called the Hurricanes. Those were some chippy games, but I played many, many years, many different teams. We even made a team one time where all us goalies, they had different levels. Okay. We took all our goalies and we put us on a team in the lowest level and we were skating, and our goalie that played for us was a skater from an upper level team. And we went undefeated 2 years in a row because us as goalies, we play defense knowing how, hey, we don't want to leave our goalie out to dry.
Right.
Because you know how it felt, you know. And so I really learned to skate by playing goalie. Not the best skater in the world, but look, I can do the backward skating and all that and play the puck.
You're better than me. I can't even do that.
And I started refereeing too. So okay. I got a lot of exercise back in that time. Mm-hmm. And then when I turned 40, I got hurt playing in a softball tournament. So then I pretty much hung up everything because at that point I'm like, okay, I'm not invincible. I need to be able to provide for my family, but I miss it every day. But in order to not go play again, I sold half of my goalie equipment. So I wouldn't have that enticement.
It wouldn't be a temptation for you. It's like you're just sitting up in the closet or you're just looking at it in the garage or something. And it's like, you know, maybe I can still do this, knowing full well that you can't. Trust me, I've had that conversation with myself.
Yes.
You know, with my stepson playing basketball, I've had that conversation with myself. I know exactly what you're saying. Shane, anything else that I'm forgetting about when it comes down to the ice skaters that you want people that listen to the show want to know about them? What is there anything that you think that the fans, that hockey fans that listen to this program need to know about the ice skaters?
One thing I want to say, you know, it was such a big part of our lives. It was something that I'm grateful that had not only been here once, but the second rendition came back.
Yes.
Later in the 2000s. And to me, which may still be here, they remodeled the dome. Anyone knows if a team ceases operation for at least a year, for whatever reason, there's a chance they won't come back. In this case, it was out of their control. Attendance wasn't what it was, but it was still enjoyable to bring my oldest son to the original ice skaters. And then to be able to bring my younger son, who didn't get to watch me play as much, to visit and enjoy, regardless if it was 11,000 or 4,000, you know, by that time, Lafayette, Louisiana had become a hockey town. We knew the rules. We knew what the passion of the game is. I'm a big Avalanche fan now. Was fortunate that they had two NHL exhibition games in the Cajun Dome because of the ice skaters. And I got to see Patrick Waugh play in person. It was the Avalanche played the Blues and the Predators played the Blues. Okay. So the two games. But just to be able, because I would have never gone had this not come here, and developed a lot of friendships of people I met at the games. Because everybody knows South Louisiana, everybody wants to have a good time together. They'll cook food and say, come eat with us, right?
Yeah.
And there are plenty tailgating atmospheres where you had, we're in Mardi Gras season, right? Mm-hmm. So you had the Cajun Heartland State Fair would come into the Cajun Dome parking lot, and you had ice skater games and then playoffs and all that going on. And what better? I mean, you have a fair at the same time you're having a hockey game. And we just had such a blast, many memories. Would love to see it come back. We do still have a junior hockey team here in Lafayette, the Drillers. Mm-hmm. I've been to a few games, but to me, you know, ice skaters are just, if everybody knew, everybody knew. You didn't even have to say, you know, where you were from. If you talked about ice skaters, they knew about it. Even when we made road trips, my wife and I and my oldest followed the team a few times on the road trips. And they hated us. They hated us. There was no better feeling than going in another team's barn and getting booed, because we were the, I don't know, I don't want to call us the Patriots because we didn't win championships, right? Mm-hmm. But we were one of those top echelon of teams that people hated, because we'd go into their house, beat them up, win the game, and they knew it. And, you know, so whether, you know, you think of that part, or you think of the memories of the friendships and just the memories of the games, man, I get excited. I still have all my ice getter jerseys. Some people sell their memorabilia. I can't part with it.
You can't part with it, right?
No, it's a part of me, and it was a part of me for a long time, and really, really, truly miss it.
Man, Shane, you've educated me, and I'm really sure that you're going to educate everybody that's out there that's listening to this. I'm impressed by your knowledge of this, and I really thank you so much for joining me to talk about the Ice Gators, reminiscing. And when you said that, when you have a hockey game right next to a fair, the only thing I can think of is that famous phrase that we say all the time: "Only in Louisiana, only in Louisiana."
Yes, you are so right, Louisiana, my boy.
Well, Shane, once again, man, thank you for joining me, and then we're gonna talk more. I'm going to invite you back on to talk some more sports, man. I know that for certain. And you got an open invitation to join me anytime.
I appreciate you having me. I had a blast, man. Thank you.
You are listening to the Sports History Podcast You Didn't Know You Needed, the Historically Speaking Sports Podcast, a podcast that places a historical twist on today's sports headlines. And just a reminder, if you happen to like what you hear here and you'd like to hear more, please do not hesitate to like and subscribe to the podcast. Also, you could drop us a line here at historically.speaking.sports@gmail.com. Also, you could follow us on Twitter at historicallysp2. And now to the NFL. Super Bowl 58 is set. The Kansas City Chiefs, led by Patrick Mahomes and Travis Kelce, defeated the presumptive league MVP Lamar Jackson and the Baltimore Ravens 17-10 in Baltimore to reach the Super Bowl for the fourth time in five seasons, and looking to go back-to-back and become the NFL's new dynasty if they have not already. The Chiefs, who had somewhat of a shaky season, still managed to win the AFC West title and avenge an earlier season loss to the Buffalo Bills by winning on the road during the playoffs, something the Chiefs never really had to do much of over the years. Then turned around to win on the road again, as if to prove that it was not a fluke. The Mahomes-Kelce tandem teamed up for one touchdown, while the running of Isaiah Pacheco ran in for another, spoiling Baltimore's magical season. Speaking of magical seasons, the Detroit Lions, who were in the conference championship game for the first time since 1991 and became America's team over the last couple of weeks, really pushed the San Francisco 49ers in Santa Clara. The Niners, who were playing in their record 19th NFC championship game, was led by second-year quarterback Brock Purdy. He used his legs as well as his arm to make key plays down the stretch, as the Niners held on for a 34-31 win to reach the team's eighth Super Bowl and their second in 5 years. In their last appearance in the big game, it was against this very same Chiefs team, who was looking to win their first Super Bowl since January of 1970 in Super Bowl IV. On February 2nd, 2020, in Miami, the Chiefs overcame a 10-point deficit heading into the fourth quarter. They defeated the Niners 31-10 as Mahomes was named the game's most valuable player. He passed for 286 yards with a pair of touchdowns and also recorded a rushing touchdown during the game. Now it's a rematch in Sin City. Could the Chiefs join the likes of the Patriots, Steelers, Packers, Dolphins, and Cowboys that repeated as world champions? and become a bona fide dynasty? Or will the Niners return to their glory behind a young offensive-minded coach and a quarterback that was once known as Mr. Irrelevant? We will definitely find out these things in a couple of weeks. Coming up after the break, we will send a shout out to a Hall of Fame football coach who began his most famous tenure with the backdrop of one of the darkest days in the history of a city that would be his home. Also, his hiring was one of the most unusual. The story of Don Coryell and the day he became head coach of the then San Diego Chargers. Coming up on this new episode of the Historically Speaking Sports Podcast, a member of the Sports History Network.
The Pigskin Tales podcast is part of the Sports History Network, your headquarters for the sports yesteryear. Hosted by Ross Bliley, the Pigskin Tales podcast takes you on a journey through life of pro football stars such as Ernie Nevers, Red Grange, and Fran Tarkenton. Plus, you might not know them real well, but you can hear stories about Bill Brown, Grady Alderman, and Dave Osborne. You can learn more on these players at sportshistorynetwork.com/podcasts/pigskin-tales.
To conclude this episode of the Historically Speaking Sports Podcast, we do what we always do at this point. It is send a shout out to an individual or team or event in the world of sports that has been maybe overlooked or forgotten about, but is very relevant to this day and sports fans really need to be reminded of. This past week, the biggest domino to fall in the NFL's annual offseason coaching sweepstakes was when Jim Harbaugh, who recently led the University of Michigan to a national championship, was named the new head coach of the Los Angeles Chargers. Now, as many of you know, I have been a lifelong fan of the Lightning Bolts, and to me, this was obviously welcome news. It also reminded me of something. On September 25th, 1978, Chargers special team star and reserve running back Hank Bauer was on his way to the Chargers training facility for meetings and practice. As he drove along the freeway, he noticed random pieces of clothing and suitcases and charred machine parts littering the highway. Just then, a special bulletin was read aloud on his car radio saying that there was a major plane crash that happened in the North Park section of San Diego. A Boeing 727 collided in midair with a small single-engine Cessna aircraft, and both planes crashed, killing a total of 134 people, injuring 9, and destroying or seriously damaging 22 residences. It was the worst air disaster in the history of the city of San Diego. Bauer listened to the radio report in his car for a few minutes before entering the team offices. As he entered, he ran into longtime San Diego sports writer Jerry McGee. McGee asked him, "So, what do you think of the news?" Bauer answered, "Wow, it's the worst thing I'd ever heard of." "The worst thing you ever heard?" the reporter asked him with puzzled bewilderment. "Yeah. It's a tragedy. I'm completely heartbroken, man. It's the worst news I've ever heard." "Hiring Don Coryell was the worst news you ever heard?" asked McGee. "Wait," said Bauer, "we hired Don Coryell as coach?" "Yeah." "Man, I thought you were talking about the plane crash," Bauer said. McGee explained, "No, you guys got a new coach." "Wait, what plane crash?" On one of the darkest days in the history of San Diego was also one of the brightest days in the sports history of that Southern California city. San Diego's great coaching icon was coming home. Now, a decade earlier, Coryell was the winningest coach in San Diego state history. Now, there are coaches that are considered offensive geniuses, but Don Coryell could be considered an offensive mad scientist. During his time at San Diego State, he installed a new formation called the I-formation and came up with a pro-set offensive alignment. Now, the Aztecs became one of the highest scoring teams in college football through the decade of the 1960s, with future NFL quarterbacks such as Don Horn, Dennis Shaw, and Brian Sipe. By the early 70s, Coryell decided to take his flying circus to the NFL, becoming head coach of the then St. Louis Cardinals. He took over the reins in 1973 and would lead the Cardinals to back-to-back NFC East titles in 1974 and 75, which is an incredible accomplishment considering that they were in the same division at that time with the Dallas Cowboys and Washington Redskins, two major NFC powers. Yet Coryell couldn't maintain that success in St. Louis, and by early 1978, he was let go by the Cardinals. Now, fast forward to September of that year. The Chargers were coming off of a 7-7 season under former Los Angeles Rams coach Tommy Prothrow. It was the Chargers' first non-losing season since 1969. And although the Chargers were looking to build off of such of a positive end to 1977, the 78 campaign saw San Diego struggle out of the gate. After beating the Seattle Seahawks 24-20 in the Kingdome, the Chargers would face the Raiders in their home opener. The game would be remembered for all time as the Holy Roller Game. That was when Raiders, down by 20-14 late in the fourth quarter, saw their Hall of Fame quarterback Ken Stabler sacked and, apparently, fumbled the ball when it was batted forward by Pete Banaszak, then recovered by tight end Dave Casper for the game-winning touchdown. The play was so egregious that it led to several rule changes that would have denied the Raiders a touchdown if that play was run today. That would begin a string of losses that included a 27-14 loss to the defending AFC champion Denver Broncos and a lackluster 24-3 destruction at home to the lowly Green Bay Packers. Something had to be done. On the day of the infamous plane crash, September 25th, 1978, at 5 a.m., yes, 5 a.m., Coach Prothrow phoned Chargers owner Eugene Klein to offer his resignation as head coach, saying the team needed to be shaken up. No joke. So Klein thought it would be remembered. Klein thought about it and remembered Coryell, who had success at San Diego State, was available. By 7 a.m., while most people were having their coffee, Coryell was on his way to the training facility to become the next head coach of the Chargers, and as they say, the rest is history. Coryell would finish the season as head coach and lead the Chargers to their first winning season in 9 years, finishing at 9-7. In 1979, the Chargers became an NFL offensive juggernaut with Hall of Fame quarterback Dan Fouts at the controls. And he became the first quarterback since Joe Namath to pass for over 4,000 yards in a single season. His targets were John Jefferson and Hall of Famers Charlie Joyner and Kellen Winslow. That season, the Chargers would win their first of three consecutive AFC West division titles, as sports writers dubbed the Chargers offense Air Coryell. Now, even though the Chargers never reached the summit of a Super Bowl, the Chargers became big time box office as they were the most exciting teams in the NFL. Now, in the present day, Jim Harbaugh is now the next coach of the Bulls and will try to lead them to that elusive Super Bowl title. And he is the latest of a line of coaches that were offensive minded. True to the Chargers' legacy. And that will do it for this edition of the Historically Speaking Sports Podcast. Thank you guys for listening. This podcast is coming to you from the Bill King Memorial Studio in the sports wing of TM4 Enterprises, located in suburban Atlanta in the shadow of Stone Mountain. To get more content of the Historically Speaking Sports Podcast, you can check us out on Twitter at HistoricallySP2, or you can send us a line at historically.speaking.sports@gmail.com. And if you have not done so already, please subscribe to the show. Tell your family, tell your friends, tell your neighbors, hell, tell a passerby on the street about us if you think they like sports history. Once again, thank you for joining me, and also a special thank goes out to my good friend Shane Derowin for joining me on this episode. And until next time, stay blessed, stay cool, and be your best in everything you do. Peace.
Hey there, Sports History fan. This is Arnie Chapman, aka the Football History Dude, and I wanted to thank you for stopping by to listen to another episode here on the Sports History Network. Our podcasters are passionate about uncovering and sharing sports stories from yesteryear. And if you didn't know it already, we have over 30 shows across the network covering all sorts of sports history topics. In fact, here's a glimpse into one of our awesome podcasts here on the network.
Each week, the official Football Learning Academy podcast will take you deep into the history of pro football through interviews with players, coaches, or administrators in the NFL, as well as interviews with Pro Football Hall of Fame selectors, authors, and historians. You'll learn how the game evolved and important moments that shaped the sport into what it is today. And don't miss the Pro Football History Nugget of the Week. Listen to the official Football Learning Academy podcast on the Sports History Network.
How about that? I bet you're super hyped to go listen to that new podcast, right? Well, to learn about this show and all the other podcasts on the network, head over to sportshistorynetwork.com/podcasts. Again, that's sportshistorynetwork.com/podcasts. Head over there today to find your next favorite sports history podcast.